I woke up this morning with the sun down shining in.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis.
I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
The f*** you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sun down shining in. I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
Welcome up, it's Action Jackson. I'm Kamau Ryan on the board. S&P futures down 19, NASDAQ futures down 86. This is after the... NVIDIA conference. NVIDIA is down 1267 to 871. I think it was over 900 at one point yesterday. We also have the Bank of Japan ending the world's only negative rate regime, a historic move, and abandons yield curve control. Do we have Professor Carl?
You do.
What do you make of this Japan thing? You know, the central bank abandoned its yield curve control and most of its asset purchasing aimed at policy easing. The move sparked a sell-off in the end. They had been buying stock ETFs. Don't they own like 35% of the market or some huge number? Or is that my number too high? They own a chunk of the market, don't they?
Yeah, it's utterly ridiculous. And, you know, it's the sort of the amusing part of it is the number of pundits that have opined over the years that the Federal Reserve is doing this. I said, well, actually, no, they're not. And not only do they supposedly, publish what they hold, right? I mean, assuming that you believe that they would never lie, right?
Right.
But the other problem is that it really is factually illegal for them to do that. Now, during the 08 crash, they were buying mortgage-backed securities that were Fannie and Freddie paper, which was illegal as well. That was retroactively changed, but that was an unlawful act. Okay, so I mean, the conspiracy crazies do have some basis for their skepticism, shall we say.
What makes you think they've stopped buying mortgage-backed securities?
Well, I didn't say they'd stop. No. I said that at the only ones, so the stricture is that in the actual enabling law for the Federal Reserve to exist, it states that their allowable things to be bought have to be things that are backed by the full faith and credit of the federal government. All right. So, and that's a very strong thing. Okay. I mean, that's a There isn't really any wiggle room in there. And the issue at the time was that Fannie and Freddie paper on the front page of the prospectus, right, specifically said these securities are not backed.
Right.
Okay. I mean, it was explicitly there. Now, everybody assumed that they, in fact, sort of, kind of were. However, the black letter of the law was that no, they weren't, and so you know, then of course Fannie and Freddie both failed, you know, because they were publicly traded entities, right? So then they failed, and when they failed, then all of a sudden that backstop became explicit, so retroactively the purchases were made legal. But at the time that they were initiated, they were not legal. And the only exception to that is that the Fed is allowed to buy what are called revenue anticipation notes, from the states. That is an explicit exception in the statute, and that is a that is a debt certificate issued by a state entity against projected tax revenues within the next 12 months. So they are allowed to buy those. So basically, kind of like a short-term muni of sorts would be probably the best way to think about those.
Well, the only problem with buying, well, there's a lot of problems with buying mortgage-backed stuff, but if you buy them at 6% and the rates drop to 3, you're going to get, all you're going to do is get the things refinanced, so they come right back at you. So in order to maintain whatever number you think you need to have, you have to keep buying.
Well, the biggest problem that you have with any kind of a debt security of that sort, and this, you know, I listened to the interview that Stockman did with a podcaster a few days ago, and
he was a guest here. He was my worst guest ever.
Well, he was making the same point I've been making for the last, you know, 15 years since I started writing my column, which is that the environment that we have been in until the last year or so is unprecedented in modern times, and essentially nobody in the financial world, you'd be one of the few exceptions simply because you probably have white hair like I've got, has ever seen an environment other than that, okay? And in the financial world, in the trading world, essentially nobody has. I mean, maybe Art Cashin.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And that is that we have lived in a world where the way to make your business work, the way to make your X work, whatever it is, business, government, whatever have you, is always to roll down and refinance because... That's first off, corporations essentially never pay off paper. Okay, they always roll it. But over the last, you know, since the 1980s, the cost of doing that has always been lower. The general trend in interest rates has been from the upper left to the lower right. And so that has always been the game. Okay, the problem with getting drunk on that is that you get this idea that is never going to change, and you're always going to be able to do that, and therefore that gets built into your assumptions. Well, now, of course, it has changed. And the issue with that is the same issue that we have with illegal immigration and offshoring labor and all of this. And that is, let's say you have a $1 million company, and you have a 10% operating margin, okay? And I'm just using nice round numbers so it's easy to visualize this. Well, that means that your gross profit is 100 grand, right? On, you know, 10% of 1 million. Okay. So it's 100 grand. And you hire 5 illegal aliens. You pay them under the table, so you do not pay any employment taxes. They work for less because no taxes are being taken out of their money, all right? So therefore, they cost you less. They are happier than a U.S. employee, a citizen employee, who's actually has to pay taxes because he's going to comply with the law, and so are you. And so by doing this, you manage to take your $100,000 operating margin and add 10% to it. So now you have $110,000 operating margin, right? All right, now that looks, that, you know, you like this, right, if as a business owner, because that's, you know, that's another 10% of your operating margin. As a result, you're also more competitive in the marketplace, so your business expands. All right. So the next year, you now have $2 million of revenue. And you expanded your operating margin this last year by $10,000, which is 10%. Now, you wish to expand your operating margin next year. Putting on the same amount of illegal labor does not expand your operating margin by 10%. It expands it by 5. All right? This is a problem because Wall Street always wants to see an acceleration that goes up. They never want to see a deceleration. If you ever have that happen, you're going to get hammered. So, as a result, You now have locked yourself into an exponential model of actions that you need to see. Whether you do them yourself, you hire more illegal labor, you offshore more of your stuff, a.k.a. the car companies in the second case, or you need to have some other exponential series you can exploit, like, for example, refinancing your debt at ever lower interest rates.
And even more of it.
Well, and more of it, yeah, but or at the same interest rate, right? You know, the same payment. The rate goes down. You know, if you start with 10% interest and it goes to 5%, you can have double the amount of money out on loan for the same amount of interest.
Well, you can also, the game in the last 15 years, 20 years, has been to buy your own stock back with money to borrow less than your return.
Right. So, I mean, but the
point... But all you're doing is leveraging yourself up.
Well, that's right, Chief. But the point that I have made to people for over all this time is that the root of all of these problems is that it's not the first year, the first time that you do this thing. It's that you have stepped onto an exponential series. And in order to continue to make those numbers work, you're going to have to do it at an exponentially expanding rate forevermore into the future. And as soon as you stop, all of that snaps back in your face. And so this is the root of all of the bad things that have been built out. And the whole reason you have a business cycle, absent this kind of tampering that we've had over the last 30 or so years, is that everybody gets a little too exuberant in their expectations. Not necessarily a lot overly exuberant, but everyone gets a little bit, everyone gets a little full of themselves. Okay, it's the nature of business, it's the nature of human beings. We all get a little full of ourselves, and that's just the way life is. Okay, so we get a little full of ourselves, we go a little too far, and then without this kind of enabling, we get whacked upside the head, and some of us go bankrupt. All right, and the survivors pick up the pieces at the pennies on the dollar and become stronger over time. New entrants come in that, again,
which is getting harder and harder to do, by the way. New entrants.
Well, but you do that. Okay. Well, yeah, but that's because of this exponential series that we've had going on.
Well, it's also because, you know, it's in some areas it's hard to get banking, it's hard to get loans. The difference in how much people have to pay in a small business versus a large business is dramatic. That's why these places have grown this much.
Oh yeah, but this is also this is why having people that either don't understand this stuff, or worse, do understand it and have been exploiting it in the private sector.
You never understand not wearing enough clothes till the temperature drops one day.
Right.
And unfortunately, well, you can hear about it all you want, but unless it happens to you.
You're not
going
to believe it until you get an inversion downstairs.
Yeah, but I mean, there's no quite, I mean, what Kraus was talking about, I'm explaining it as simple as possible. If you have, let's say Carl and I pony up $500,000 apiece, all right? We open up two hamburger stands and we pay for all of it out of our own, out of equity, all right? So the $1 million. And we're making 15% return, which, you know, you could probably do if you did a nice job and worked hard.
Right.
So all of a sudden we want to put up a third one and we expect to make the same amount. Well, if we can borrow at 5%, we probably are pretty foolish by putting up another $500,000 ourselves, because now with the same million, we can borrow at 5, but now we're going to be making 10, but it's 10 on borrowed money. So instead of making the 15% we're making on the million, which is 150 grand, we're now going to be 250. That 15 plus the 10, which is another 15 minus the 5, and interest gives us 10, right? So at some level, it's very rare for a company that's making decent returns to want zero borrowings, zero long-term debt. It becomes part of your capital plan. Now, the question is how much? Now, if you were absolutely guaranteed to only make 15% every year, which is hard to do, and a bank is willing to go at you at 5 or 6% like forever, you could probably run the math and say, why don't we borrow all of it and take our $1 million out? Because now we've got $2 left in here, one apiece, and we're swimmingly. Not only are we making 15% of the business, we're also our equity is. We now got our money back, and we're making.
Well, yeah, your ROE is now infinite because your E's zero.
Right. So you're at the. But the problem there is, all of a sudden now, if we have a bad year, if we don't keep our million, like, in a separate account somewhere to put back in for a rainy day, or if we now have 30 hamburger stands, now we've got a problem, right? And it's the problem that's, I mean, because companies usually, and you have cash flow issues sometimes too. You know, a lot of companies don't go out of business, they don't make money, they go out of business because cash flow problems, and very few people understand that these days. That's, I don't even think they teach that. Maybe they do, but I mean, you can have a business where your suppliers, they want you to pay them in 30 days, and your customers pay you in 60. Well, that's a problem because growth then means you need more money just to grow, in addition to whatever it costs to build a new plant. So there's a lot of intricacies in here that, when things are is like they are for a while, like Carl's claiming, people don't even understand how things can go bad the other way. Because now you're not only borrowing for the business, for the new building, you're borrowing to cover the 30 or 60 days you're not getting paid, which is yet another issue. Right, Carl?
Well, yeah. And the thing is that once this kind of cancerous thing gets going, because it is an exponential series, it's just like a cancer that metastasizes. Well, you know, we all walk around all the time. Most people don't know this, or if they may know it, they need to hear it. Every one of us, from before we're born, has cancerous cells in our body all the time. Okay? That's just a fact. Why? Because we live in a place that is bombarded all the time with ionizing radiation from space, and there's no way to get around that. That's, you know, cosmic rays are extraordinarily energetic things. Go run some of the calcs on what you'd have to do if you attempted relativistic speed travel, something approaching it, and your eyes will pop out of your head. Because, of course, you know, the basic physical equation for kinetic energy is 1/2 mv². So as the velocity goes up, guess what happens? This, by the way, is the same reason that crashing into something at 60 miles an hour is a whole lot worse than hitting something. It's not double as bad as hitting something at 30, okay? But your immune system is capable of keeping this under control, and does, and seeks out these rogues and kills them. And that's why we don't all die within, you know, minutes or hours of our birth. So this is fine right up until that exponential expansion gets out of hand. Your immune system is incapable of dealing with it because it's gone too far. It gets overrun, and now you have actual cancer clinically. But the idea that you just all of a sudden magically acquired that tumor, no. The aggregation of all of that into a tumor, yes. But that you didn't have any cancerous cells in your body before you had that's BS. Every single living organism has them in its body all the time. And the same thing with a balanced economic system where debt on some kind of manageable understood thing, we could get rid of it if we needed to, if the economic conditions went the wrong way, is not necessarily a bad thing. You know, the average person, the average Joe who goes out and buys a house with a mortgage, fully expecting that during the time he's going to live in that building, he can pay on the original terms. Okay, whatever, come hell or high water, he can find a way to do it. It's not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, it's arguably a very good thing because you have stability there.
Well, it comes down to me. This was one of my jobs for both Allied Van Lines and Pullman. If there was a capital expenditure or something, the first thing you would do is try and figure out if it matched, if it exceeded the rate of return that you required. So, if you were going to decide whether we're going to, you know, build a part or go out and buy it, you would look to see if you could buy the machine and
right.
build it and the people, and if you could do that and return 15% on the value of the part. Every company had their cutoff, and which makes it even more bizarre, Carl. I'm surprised you didn't mention when you start having different rates in different countries, it gets even more bizarre, because that's really what happened in 2007. The people who were buying, not everybody, but a lot of the people who were buying those mortgage-backed securities, and you can, and at any level of 2007, you can step in and say, here's where the problem was. You could say that some people were getting mortgages that didn't pay enough down payment, didn't have skin in the game. You can talk about that at one level, and I think you'd be accurate. However, the fact is there were $35 of debt on every dollar of mortgage. Now, the person who put down the 1% and, quote, maybe didn't deserve a mortgage, quote, unquote, he was worth one of the dollars, or he or she. But the rest of it, we had people borrowing money in Japan at 2%, because if you looked at it, you'd say, wait a minute, these mortgages are only 6.5%. Why would somebody go crazy buying paper at 6.5%? It's not like it was 10 or 12 or 15, right? It was 6.5. But if you and I could go to Japan to get a line of credit for 2, forgetting the exchange risk and forgetting the next side of that transaction.
Forgetting.
The fact is, if you and I put up $1 million, you know, we're winging our money around like if we had it, if we put up $1 million and borrowed 20 at 2 and now have mortgages at 6.25, we're getting 4.5% on $21 million, and we only got $1 million in the game. I mean, you and I could do that all day, right? Until of course it turns. But that's why my biggest criticism of the whole mess is you and I, well, you research more than I do, maybe you'll tell me I'm wrong, but I don't think we can identify that kind of money flow. The only people that probably can are the Fed, because they see the money coming from all these overseas every day and back and forth. And these are things that they track, because they're the ones that are, they've maintained the connections. It's when the yen settles with the dollar and when it settles with the euro. This is a very complex area. When people say get rid of the Fed, be careful what you say there, because...
Absolutely. Yeah. Back when I first started writing my column, one of the things I did was a quarterly report on a Z1, which is the Fed's flow of funds report. And it is arguably the most comprehensive piece of information in one place on where the money comes from and where it goes, right, in terms of credit and everything else. And the Federal Reserve is, because they run Fedwire, they have their finger on that pulse, and they know more about it than anybody else. And I stopped writing it for two reasons. One is that the Fed has this propensity, which makes me extremely angry that they get away with this, but they do, to take entire categories and recast them here we just did this, okay? And when Obama took over all the student lending, they did one of them. And the problem with that is that it totally jacks all of the prior stuff that you've analyzed off of it.
Right, so you change the whole game.
Yeah, well, it creates a discontinuity that makes it impossible to compare, you know, from one period to another and draw a valid conclusion. And they do this on purpose, okay? They don't have to do that. They could add another column to it, leave the old stuff alone, and have a new aggregation.
But that would not be the purpose is turmoil.
Yeah, this is a very deliberate decision on their part, okay, to do it this way. That was the first thing. And the amount of work that I had to do to try to untangle Charlotte's web in that situation was unbelievable. But then the second part of it was that it was the most poorly circulated and consumed piece of reporting that I did out of everything.
Really? Well, I mean, we've only got a minute here, Carl, because Russell's going to give us a half-hour rendition today on volatility, because he wrote a serious book on volatility, probably the best one out there. And both Kenny's on a cruise lecturing, And Joel is on vacation, so we had the half hour. So Russell said he'd come in and talk about volatility, which every week when he's on, we try and talk about, because that's his probably the thing he's, well, he's expert on a lot of stuff, but he's, but my, one, I have a buddy who will go by the name of Robert, which that's his first name. He works at the Fed, and that's what he does, is he's one of the guys that's involved in these international settlement stuff.
Yeah.
And for a real long time, I don't know if you knew this, Carl, or if I ever told you, the way they did it was, like, if you talk about dollars versus euros or whatever it all was before euros, these are massive amounts of money every day. They put the stock market to shame in terms of the money changing hands. And the I think it was the dollar versus the euro used to settle at something like 11 o'clock, and the euro versus the dollar would settle at 12 or something. It was off by an hour. They did one half and then they did the other. So they were essentially had their pants down for an hour, and for lack of a better term. Sure enough, one day, one bank went belly up, in some medium-sized bank or somebody over in Germany went belly up in the hour and caused some huge, because a regular-sized bank might have, you know, a couple of billion dollars that they're transferring from euros to dollars in any given day. Just some people buying stuff from Europe or people, you know, whatever. It's nothing. I mean, if you got a watch company, you might be buying the movements or the cases from Switzerland. You know, so I mean, this adds up real fast. And they ended up having to redo the whole system. So now the system, everything clears the same instant both ways, which you would think probably should have been the design in the first place, but it wasn't. It was too complex. So now they do it. It all happens at the same minute. So it's not like the Fed doesn't do stuff. I mean, they do.
Oh, no, it's their settlement. I mean, the whole reason we have a functional payment system is them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, you may not like the Federal Reserve, but 95% of what they do is not monetary policy. It's making sure that when you move money around, it actually gets there.
When you write a check, they clear it.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's not just wire transfers, although that certainly is a big part of it. And it's that when you move money from one place to another, it actually goes where you told it to go.
Well, Carl, thank you. We'll talk more on Friday. We still have to dig into more of these labor type things, because all of a sudden now I was at my Myers on Sunday morning. I usually am, and just what we were talking about last week, the guy said we got a little bump in wages, and we also got cut from 40 to 37 and a half hours.
Nah, gee, what have I been saying?
Yeah.
In the figures for a while.
No, but that doesn't. I don't know if they do any benefits or they don't, but isn't 32 hours the magic one where you don't have to give benefits?
Well, it's not benefit. The one that counts is the Obamacare thing.
Okay.
Insurance thing.
Well, prior
to that, it didn't matter so much.
Why don't we kick this around on Friday and just what happens every time you drop an hour or two? I mean,
yep.
All right, buddy. You take care. S&P futures down 23 now. NASDAQ futures down 110. We're going to break. We'll come back with Mr. Russell Rhodes.
Do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to factor in the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other life decision. Your brain is smarter than your gut, and that's why you owe it to yourself to read Luckbox. We've made it easy because Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with timely, actionable trading ideas, and equips you with savvy investing tactics you don't already know, all while exploring how to live your best life through music, spirits, food, sports, travel, fitness, and a whole lot more. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on controlling their financial futures. It's for overachievers and alpha types who don't buy into Wall Street's investment gurus. It's for mavericks who believe in life, luxury, and the pursuit of happiness. It's for you! Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. a longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at cognoshr.com. Cognos HR. Innovation in Human Resources. Licensed in Illinois.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. Confused about investing these days? I suspect you are not alone. Investing was never easy, although at times it may have seemed so. I think one reason behind the current concern, although maybe not explained as such, is how the fluctuation in the American dollar and the associated politics is affecting your investments and your wealth. It may not be enough to make some money in your investments. You may need now to make enough to exceed the amount that your leadership is depreciating the value of the dollars you've worked your whole life to accumulate. That same leadership has seen fit to maneuver risk-free interest rates to near zero. Providing positive risk-averse returns in a zero-interest and declining real wealth environment is by far the toughest assignment I've ever had in my years as a money manager. I'm sure that a lot of you have heard that one way to possibly deal with this problem is to invest in so-called hard currencies like silver and gold, the idea being that they will retain their relative value in the face of devaluation of paper currencies like the dollar. To be honest, I have never been a gold bug. I've always had faith that having enough dollars and a good investment strategy was good enough. Now I'm not so sure. But I do know that if I did invest in gold or silver, I'd want to do it in the same manner as we do with PTI for investments in the market, with defined risk. If you feel the need to invest in gold or silver, we can do it using the same strategies that we use for our protected index program. No matter what you invest in, we feel that you need to know and control your risk. Find us at PTISecurities.com. That's PTISecurities.com.
Stocks, jocks,
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Ryan on the board. S&P futures down 23. S&P futures down 117. We have Dow futures down 85. We've got our big seven, which was all up yesterday. NVIDIA's down 14 today. The rest of them are down a little bit. Tesla down 2. They were up yesterday. Microsoft down 2. And Meta down 4. Fitty. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX up 8. Call that flat. FTSE down 17.2%. Ekron up 15.2%. So not much going on over there. In Asia, big bank of Japan decision yesterday to stop buying ETFs and let the interest rates go positive. It hasn't done anything. The Nikkei is actually up 243 to 40,003, so back over 40,000. Hang Seng down 207. That's 1.2%. Shanghai down 22. That's 0.7%. Yesterday we were at a big day. Dow was up 75, only the S&P was up 32. NASDAQ up 130, so trying to get back what we lost, some of what we lost last week. Bonds down 1 basis point, 4.32. The Bund unchanged. Japan actually is unchanged. Actually down to 0.74, which is kind of weird, considering what the central bank said yesterday. Oil down a penny, 82.71. Brent down 5 cents, 86.84. Natural gas up 3 cents, 173. We got the U.S. dollar still at 108 against Europe, 127 against the pound. Not much going on there. We've got gold down $6, 21.58, kind of mired in this 21.50-something range. Silver down 12 cents, 25.12. And we have Bitcoin down 4,300 to 62,832. So we have MicroStrategy, which was 1,700, and Friday night is now 1,339. Ouch. What do you got for us, Trevi Weather Sports?
Hello, hello, hello. Today, let's see. Oh, yeah, it's Tuesday. You know what that means? The Bulls beat the Portland Trail Blazers 110 to 107 on Sunday.
No, last night.
What's that?
Last night, I watched it.
Oh, I thought that was Sunday. My bad. Well, the good news is the Bulls still won.
Yeah.
I'll take my wins where I can get them in Chicago, Tim.
That's right.
That said, the Cubs also beat the Rangers 8-6 on Sunday. The Sox lost to the Cleveland Guardians 5-8, and the Blackhawks somehow beat the Sharks 5-2. That notwithstanding, I am still thinking about the Illini win. How about you, Tom?
There you go. And now they play. They got a third seed, so mm-hmm. We'll have to be checking that out. Tomorrow we'll do our NCAA pre-game thing. So there you go.
Gotcha. In regards to weather, it is currently 30 in Chicago with a high of 53 with some breezes and a few clouds to come. Right now in Phoenix, Arizona, it's 50 degrees with a high of 76, also with partly cloudy skies. In regards to traffic, the inbound Kennedy is looking at a solid 52 minutes, inbound Eden's 53 minutes, inbound Eisenhower 45, inbound Dan Ryan 17-minute travel time, and the inbound Stevenson is sitting at a solid 40 minutes.
Do we have the professor?
Yes.
Hey, what's up, man?
Southbound I-65 north of Indianapolis, totally clear. There's the end of your traffic report, because that's where I'm at right now.
Well, there you go. You already passed.
I'm riding with an unnamed professor, and they yelled at the phone during the first half hour when you said that we don't teach cash flows. We teach the crap out of cash flows.
I'm sure a lot of schools do.
We do.
I'm
sure they don't.
But, well, Kevin texted me also. I'm sure you do, but the question is, how many people pay attention? I mean, most of the people that I see in business don't.
You know how I make them pay attention? I tell them this is how Warren Buffett picks stocks.
Ah, there you go.
And it is, because that's what he does. He discounts back all the cash flows. He wants a really consistent forecast of those cash flows, which is where the boring company part comes from. But the second I tell him that, you know, this is how Buffett values companies, you know, I get a whole lot of attention, and then I get a whole lot of, well, why do they talk about earnings on CNBC all the time? Why don't they talk about cash flows? I mean, I know you're a CNBC guy, but they show cash flows when they show the cash flows on Bloomberg when companies report their earnings now.
Well, you and your fellow professor,
becoming more and more of a thing.
I think you both would agree with me that is probably 99% of the reason why in 5 years there won't be any independent pharmacies.
Because of
cash flow. When they get paid from the states versus when they have to pay for the drugs.
Oh, yeah, no, that's and you know, we've talked about my healthcare finance class. That's a huge issue in that space. But I'm not going to hijack today like I did last
week.
Because I did that, we ran out of time, and I never said VIX once except for...
Well, Russell,
yeah, we can talk about VIX next week.
Well, tell us about, A, what it is, but also on a market level versus like a MicroStrategy level, where the stock was 1,700 yesterday morning. The straddle for this Friday night was like 370, and I'm sitting there going, that's kind of a lot. It's 20%, and guess what? The stock's already blown through to 370. So how it works, take it from the bottom. It's the implied volatility of the market, not of the stocks.
Exactly. And I've done some studies on this part. Implied volatility for, you know, broad-based indexes does behave differently than implied volatility for options on individual stocks. And I know MicroStrategy is a really interesting story these days because they're issuing the $600 million in convertible bonds, and they're going to put all that money in Bitcoin. And I guess we should have realized that that's the kind of announcement that you see when a market is topping, because Bitcoin's $10,000 lower than when they announced that one. But the implied volatility for broad-based indexes, the situation there is it's an inverse relationship, because the majority of option trading on like the S&P 500, especially at the institutional level, is on the put side. Typically, we trade about 1.5 to 2 puts for every calls in the SPX every day. So the implied volatility of S&P 500 index options, it's really driven by the put side of the equation, whereas for individual stocks, it's a bit more balanced. And because it's being driven by the put side of the equation, even though VIX is calculated using all options that expire, basically all liquid options that expire on Friday before and a Friday after the 30-day time period, it's really driven by demand for puts. And demand for puts goes up when the market is selling off, which creates that inverse relationship between VIX and the S&P 500. So on a micro basis, and you know, I get a lot of push on this one, but on a micro basis, you want to see VIX confirming what's going on in the S&P 500. And what I mean by that is you want to see VIX around or at a new recent low when the S&P 500 is reaching a new high. And we haven't seen that. We haven't seen that for a couple of months. We haven't made a new low in the VIX since, I think, December 12th of last year. But we've had several new highs in the S&P 500, which means demand for S&P 500 puts has been holding up despite the S&P 500 doing very well. And
well, you have the,
that
have some
can be somewhat concerning to the market.
You have some cross currents in that, though, Russell, in the sense that your bands have been, your rates have been sneaking up with the market sneaking
and
up.
I think that's, I think the rate situation where we continue to see the first cut being pushed out, you know, at one time, the market was pricing in a 90% chance that we were going to get a rate cut tomorrow. And now it's pricing in a 0.8% chance. And I do think one of the, you probably, and I haven't overlaid these two numbers together, but I'll bet you if I overlaid VIX with the odds of a, the first cut being at tomorrow's meeting, that they probably have a pretty nice relationship there. Whereas the odds of that cut have approached zero, that VIX has managed to hang around a bit. And I think that's because the main reason people are bullish on the market is really the rate cut story.
Well, why, just a real stupid question, and your buddy can nudge you and speak softly if he wants. Why exactly is everybody, you and I, okay, if you put us alone in a cave for 6 months and said, the Fed has been raising rates and now they're going to lower them, we would probably assume, and if we assume what? I make an ass out of you and an ass out of me, right? We would have assumed that when you went from zero interest to 5.5, that the market would be appreciably lower than when we started. So if the Fed were to go around the other way and lower the rates, that the market would come back. Because it's simple capital asset pricing. I mean, you learn that in first day of class in freshman year, right? But the fact is, the market is way higher than when they started raising rates. So
But it did go down
a little bit. We're reaching. Well, so I'm saying the normal. You're saying like in 2007, and oh by the way, in 1987 in August, before the market turned, you had an incredible low point in your implied volatility in your puts, meaning your VIX. But we don't have it now because nothing seems to be like it's supposed to be. You don't raise rates that rapidly and have the market go up. And now everybody's saying it's going to go higher when it goes down. I don't know about that. Nothing else seems to be working like it's supposed to.
I totally have a hard time, resolving that one. Other than I think a lot of people were trying to get ahead of the first rate cuts, and now they're just kind of stuck long, assuming that we're going to tread water until we start to get major rate cuts. But the market still is just continued to go up, and it just seems to be a real disconnect between what the fixed income markets are telling us, but also what VIX is telling us relative to perceived risk in the overall market.
I think, Russell, is there a chance when somebody like you 20 years from now writes a history of this whole mess, a monetary history, you continue Milton Friedman's book? He stopped at, 1959, and you'd go from monetary history of the United States from 1960 onward. I think some of it has to do, and I could be totally wrong here, with they poured so much money into the system that even though they have stopped pouring money into the system and actually backed up just a little bit, that the money was they put in so much it was never able to be absorbed in the normal 6 month, 8 month time period that people think that monetary policy's lag is. I think it's still being absorbed to the point where
it's very possible that it's very possible that it's still being absorbed, and it's very possible that at the first sign of market weakness, because it's not being because it's run out and it's time for things to start, start paying the piper, et cetera, they'll probably sneak in some sort of quantitative easing to boost us up again. And there's just a belief that they're going to do that. I think that's one of the reasons people continue to buy stocks.
Well, the reason why people believe it is look how much money they poured back in with this Silicon Valley Bank.
And that was my, I don't know if they had to do that or not. You know, the situation didn't take us down, but I don't think it would have taken us down.
I don't either. All right, so go ahead with the VIX discussion. And I mean, you're right. It's not sometimes before a sell-off, it gets down to like 8 or 9. We're clearly not there. We're at 14.
Right.
So where does that put you?
It puts you kind of at an inflection point. And the inflection point is, do you really want to own stocks for the rest of this year? And really, the main reason to own stocks this year has been based on an interest rate outlook. And, if that interest rate outlook changes dramatically, and it's been changing slowly. And what I mean by it's been changing slowly is you've just seen this creep where the first cut keeps getting pushed out, and the first cut is being, it's actually been pushed out to July now. That's what's being priced in by the markets. What I'll be watching tomorrow afternoon is, does that number get pushed even farther out after we get the announcement from the FOMC? And, and we listen to what Powell has to say. We did get hit pretty hard on the last FOMC announcement because it became pretty clear that we weren't going to get a cut in March.
Right.
I don't think the data's there to get a cut. And then something else is, the Fed is not going to cut because they can. They're going to cut because they have to. They recall zero interest rates and not, and being behind the eight ball if they needed to cut rates when they couldn't. So you got to assume that there's this, there's this thing in the back of their minds that we don't want to get back to that very low rate environment, because if we do, then we don't have a whole lot of things to,
Well, they also are.
Do what they're charged with doing.
Russell, what is the current? I don't know that there's been a chance, because it wasn't that long ago, for academia, since I got two professors in one spot, for academia to kind of review the proceedings. And I'm not the PhD guys like you guys are, but I've been studying this because I'm fascinated by it ever since I was in grad school. And the idea that you have an interest rate of say 6 or 5. And cut it a half or raise it a half and cause some ripples by the money supply changes you need to do that. There's no doubt that that makes a difference, okay? In terms of people and what their break evens are, when they make a project, if I borrow at 6.5 versus 5.5, I better make sure there's probably a project I don't want to do. Maybe there's 1 out of 10 I don't want to do now. So does it affect business? It sure does, but I don't know what the soothsayers are going to say in retrospect. Does it do any good whatsoever to drop rates from 1.5 where nobody that we know can borrow to 1 where nobody that we know can borrow? What's the difference almost?
No,
except
there's not a whole lot of difference at all, and that's why you don't want to get down to those levels once again.
I mean, it's almost like raising it from 15 to 16. Well, okay, nobody's doing anything there anyway. What's the difference?
Yeah. No, and I do believe monetary policy-wise, they don't want to end up in a situation or leave a situation for the next guys where they're stuck with 0% interest rates. We look like we're going into a recession, and you're like, what do we do here? Go out and buy a whole bunch more bonds? I don't think they like doing the quantitative easing and the quantitative tightening. I think they'd like to get rid of that as a tool.
Well, professors don't mind taking the hit, but the rest of society, 95% of the people, if there was a chance for them to take the hit or for the next guy to take the hit, would much rather the next guy take the hit, right?
Yeah.
I mean, duh. I mean, if you're going to be president, would you rather have the recession come the year after you leave or the year before you leave?
I like to believe that people don't think like that, but I know that they do. So
yeah, right. So
that's my big. I wish I had been. If I had been a more bitter, skeptical guy when I was in my 20s, I'd probably be living alone in a cabin with my dogs. But I probably wouldn't have been duped as much as I had been duped.
Well, when if ever you and I have had these discussions, and Carl's kind of on the same page. I think Hal is a little bit as well. When are we going to stop worrying about the short-term rate and start worrying about the 10-year rate? And if we don't get this inflation down, that rate goes to 8 or something. That's a problem.
You know, I think it's something that everybody should be paying attention to, and it does tend, it creeps up when we get the numbers that make it look like we're not going to be able to get a cut sometime soon as well. But that's also a number that is closer to what businesses are going to have to borrow at. And if that number goes up an awful lot, in conjunction with, there are a lot of companies that are going to have to refinance their debt in the next 12 months. And as long as interest rates remain at relatively high levels, it's going to be very costly for them to do this.
We also have
and the risk-free rate, the short-term rate has something to do with it, but the longer-dated rates, like you're talking about, that 10-year rate, if that thing starts to creep up and we have a normal curve at elevated levels, that's going to be extremely detrimental to businesses.
Well, not to mention, there's going to be an awful lot of people that have trillions of dollars worth of debt that is trading $75 and $100.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
What the, all right.
That's a high number.
Okay, so the bottom line on this is I've had my clients, not everybody, but a few guys have called up, a few ladies as well, and said, hey, what about this VIX? If we think it's going to be a rough year with elections and everything else, should we be buying the $20 calls in the VIX in October? I don't necessarily want to say yes on that one, but what should I say?
You don't want to say yes on that one, and... One of the things with using VIX that way is how, there's not a fair value relationship between the VIX future and spot VIX, because you can't replicate spot VIX in a portfolio. And if there are people that just heard that and said, yeah, what about the exchange traded products? They own VIX futures. They're not replicating spot VIX. If I could figure out how to replicate spot VIX, I'd be planted next to you in that office there and trading the difference between spot VIX and VIX futures every day.
You can't
do that. So what happens is there's a monthly expiration, and the monthly expiration for VIX, the near month is the one that is most responsive to what's happening in spot VIX. So if you think there's going to be, and I always refer to them as volatility events, if you think there's going to be a 10-15% sell-off in the S&P 500 that happens very quickly, sometime between now and October, you actually want to, because I think today is also, or tomorrow is also, tomorrow is March VIX expiration. So you would want to use the front month, which is April. And, you could buy the 20 calls over and over again, or you could do some sort of spread. And one of the most common trades in the VIX pit, especially when you're trying to have long volatility exposure to offset a big sell-off in the stock market, is maybe selling an out-of-the-money put spread on the downside and using those funds to buy an out-of-the-money call for the upside, because your danger is a much lower VIX, and a much lower VIX is going to be accompanied by much higher stock prices. If you do get hit on that VIX trade, you should be making it up on the stock side if VIX creeps down to much lower levels. But another thing that's kind of cool about VIX is the options that kind of hold their value till in just before expiration because of that risk of a big move to the upside. So you don't lose too much on a trade like that if you don't get the volatility event, and then you can roll into the next month. Last year somebody asked me, or 2 years ago in December of 2022, somebody asked me on a different program, how would I play if I thought there were going to be a volatility spike in the next 6 months? And on the blog site that I run, that I throw stuff out there on, I actually went through the whole process from December or June of last year. It didn't work because stocks went up an awful lot, but it didn't cost a whole lot either. But that's what you want, is you want to have some sort of spread that doesn't cost a whole lot, that holds its value until close to expiration, that you can then roll to the next expiration until you get the volatility event.
Well, to put some numbers on that, if you don't mind, Russell, uh-huh. If you go out to June, the spot VIX right now is 1472, meaning where, if you look at right now, where all the implied volatility in the formulas are, yet uh-huh. the the 12 calls in June are $5, which means that's,
yeah,
that's pretty high.
That, well, and that's because the future is probably, because the options are priced, they share pricing characteristics with the futures,
right,
and not spot VIX. And that, and I mean, in reality, S&P 500 index options are based off of a forward value for the S&P 500.
Right.
But because of the fair value relationships, et cetera, we don't really worry too much about that, especially in a lower interest rate environment.
Well, the OEX, where I traded forever, had essentially had two underlyings. Had the spot.
Yeah.
But just to finish this thought, the 22 puts are 645. So that's not that's below parity. So the future's got to be somewhere around 16 and a half, not 14 and a half.
And in fact, if you think VIX is going to sit right there between now and I'm totally switching from long VIX to short VIX, but if you think VIX is going to sit right, you know, if let's say it's going to sit at 14, and you can buy a June 22 put, let's just say for $6. If VIX doesn't move at all, you make $2 off that trade.
Right. That's a big if.
Yeah.
Hey,
well, but I mean, that actually, I trade like that on a very, very consistent basis.
When,
that's exactly how I trade.
I'm going to steal a minute from Professor Hell. When the OEX first started, like we're talking 1983, and I was in that pit, and the guys who were the, we call them the sheet monkeys, the guys who traded totally off the futures, the guys from like CRT, they would trade the OEX exactly off the future. And some days we would have a discount in the puts, like at 2:45, and you could exercise every day in the OEX. So I would, in the pit, I would buy. I mean, I was never so egotistical that I would buy hundreds of them. But every night, I'd buy like a 20 lot at 2:45. And 10-15 days in a row, I made half a buck or a buck on the 20 lot by just exercising them. So finally, one of the brokers, who was a nut job, says, "You know, you don't remember Kerry Portman, do you?" He was
no, I do not.
Well, he was. I don't know. He ended up getting banned. I don't know what happened to him, but he was a decent guy.
And,
but he,
and I'll tell you, to get banned from that floor, you really got to do something bad.
Oh yeah, well,
go ahead.
Anyway, so one night he just says to everybody, "What are you doing?" This guy realizes that these things are going to be worth a dollar more in 10 minutes, and you idiots are selling it to him. And the guys are all sitting there going, "Yeah, but the futures," he goes, "he's going to exercise them in 10 minutes. But I never did more than like a 15 lot, because I always thought that these guys must have known something. I mean, we're running a discount at 10 minutes to 3. And because, you know, vol was cheap. And but, I mean, you can do
that. Well, and that's when the French would come in and sell their futures every afternoon.
Yeah, well, yeah, and it's that was also because
that was actually a thing.
Well, but it didn't last more than a couple of weeks before guys figured it out. But you know, because they would stop because they were totally off the futures. Yet the OEX had a spot price too that you could exercise every day, where the VIX is not. You cannot exercise these things, right? Or else you'd buy these puts.
No,
that's a big.
They're European style, so, and that's another reason. I mean, hell, if I could buy the June 22 puts at $6 and exercise them with VIX at 14, heck yeah.
Yeah,
but
there's a quick $2.
Yeah, that's like I said, I would be sitting there next to you and totally taking advantage of that. But and I know a lot of really smart firms have tried to figure out how to replicate spot VIX. Because when I was at SIBO and I was kind of the VIX guy for the Option Institute, they would invite me in and I would have these one-way conversations where they were drilling me about aspects of the VIX, but not sharing what. But I could tell what they were trying to do.
You can't. You got to adjust the price. Then the options fall into line.
Yeah. Well, and the way the VIX calculation works is it only uses out of the money option contracts. So like you said, you know, last I heard, you said S&P was down 23 points. Well, we have most likely crossed 4 expirations. So you have to, you know, and if you're using, you know, I'm sorry, 4 strikes. So if you're trying to replicate VIX, to make sure you're holding the right portfolio, you would need to sell 8 options and buy 8 other options.
Are we going to have to dash, Russell? Everybody has been asking for a serious VIX discussion. We just gave one. I hope we didn't shoot over the top of everybody's head. But anyway, thank you. Thank your driver. Drive safe. And have a nice week down there.
Just one last thing, because I'm on with you tomorrow.
Yep.
If anybody has a question, email it. We can continue this tomorrow.
Is that, by the way, did your team?
Because we only scratched the surface on it.
Is your team Indiana in the NCAA or not?
No, not a single one of the teams that I have any relationship with is playing in any postseason tournament.
We have the girls at Notre Dame. With injuries, we only have six of them on scholarship.
Uh huh.
That's all we got left. So.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah,
well, that's look up the Mighty Max in the NCAA Women's Tournament. They'll be the Mighty Max of this generation.
Oh God! SP Futures down 22, NASDAQ Futures down 114. Thank you. We'll be right back, Professor Elsner.
Are you one of the millions of people who suffer with pain? Do you wake up in the morning with stiffness in the lower back or neck? Why are you using medication to cover up the symptoms without treating the actual cause? Painkillers, muscle relaxants, and anti-inflammatories are not the answer. At ChiroMed, physicians are trained to detect the cause of your symptoms and to correct the underlying problem. If you're ready to listen to common sense and do what it takes to make changes in your body that can affect your health for the rest of your life, give ChiroMed a call and set up a complimentary consultation. They are located in Orland Park and can be reached at 708-403-2727. 20,000 patients over 22 years have been treated at ChiroMed, and over 90% of them have had positive results without medication or expensive surgery. Isn't it time you did something good for your body too? Give ChiroMed a call. 708-403-2727. That's 708-403-2727. Let's get you pain-free and living again.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now. Right now.
Hello, everyone. Big Stacks and Jacks. I'm talking about Ryan on the board doing something over there. SP Futures down 24, NASDAQ Futures down 122. Do we have the professor?
Hey, good morning, Tom.
How are you? Did we, Russell and I confuse the entire world with the VIX or no?
Maybe not the entire world. Your listeners, probably not.
That's one of the reasons why, even though a lot of people was a call for it, it's hard to dig into that because it's an amazingly complicated product.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah,
and because
I don't day trade. I look at the market. And I'm like, all right, what's going to look like in 5 years? So I have this long run view of it.
Well, because it's it essentially gives you the. One thing I didn't want to debate Russell on. I'm surprised he brought up the part about. More puts trade in the SPX, which maybe they do, but it almost really doesn't matter because the price of insurance, there's something called a call put parity. But if you were to say to me, pick a stock, I'm looking right at Johnson & Johnson up 9 cents. If you were to tell me and the stock's trading 156.85, and you were to say, well, value the calls and the puts. I'm a little rusty, but I'm going to say I have no idea. I got to find out where the market is. Because if I price it at a volatility of 16, and the first 10 calls are to buy, I know I'm too cheap. Okay, and the idea is people think that the traders price the market. I mean, they don't. A trader, my greatest day, Al, as a trader, even tomorrow if I started trading again. Would be to pick a price where half the people call up and are buying, and half the people call up are selling, and I'm making the spread, and at the end of the day, I go home flat. You know, that would be the perfect world, which, of course, never happens, because that would be the idea. I mean, you don't want to say, I think these puts are worth $5 and have everybody in the world calling up and buying them from me, because you're selling people insurance at a price they think it's a great buy, and I'm sitting there going, I think, you know, it's a great sell. I'm not that smart. I mean, the market sets the price. But
well, I mean, that all just points out this idea of demand and supply, right? If you have too many calls and too few puts, right, or vice versa, you're probably not at the equilibrium price.
But I'm saying I can't tell you what the price is coming out. Yeah. But if you tell me what the price of the call is, and you tell me the interest rate and the dividend and when the dividend is and where the price of the stock is, I can absolutely tell you where to put your trade. Hmm. Because there's a put-call parity.
Yeah.
And so it's not like everybody's buying puts, therefore, you know, the calls are cheaper. No, they're not. They're the same price because you you're a professor. I don't know if you know this or not. How do you manufacture a put?
How do you manufacture it?
Yeah.
You get an AI robot to run the stamping machine?
No. Right. I mean, what is a put? A put, if it goes down, the stock makes money. If it goes up, you don't lose anything, right?
Yeah. Put is just a sell, right?
But what's the exact same position? Long call, short stock.
Yeah.
Which is sort of interesting because if you give people, I'll ask you a question. You're the professor. I'll ask you, if you were to give a seminar, this is certainly after the 87 crash when all the puts exploded. If you were to say to somebody, okay, what is the safest option position? More often than not, people are going to say a covered right, because you're selling a call against stock you already have. So if the stock runs up and the call blows up in your face, the stock has it covered, and you make money. You don't make as much as you would have liked if you didn't have the short call, but you're ahead of the game. And people will say that is the safest option transaction. And then you'd say, okay, what is the most risky? Somebody's liable to say a short put. It's the exact same position. The graph's exactly the same. There's a little difference because of the interest. Because you've got unlimited risk essentially to the downside, right? And you're truncated to the upside, the same position. But the difference is when people have their stock, and maybe they've had it for a year, 6 months, 10 years, 50 years, who the hell knows, they've already made the risk decision on the stock. So if the stock goes down, they know what they have. The difference is if I short a put today and it goes down, I just made the decision today. But it's the exact same position. But you know, try not to explain that to a room of 100 people, you get nowhere, and it's the exact same position.
Yeah.
Because of the put call parity, it should be the same thing. So if somebody comes in and I'm a market maker and somebody wants to buy 100 puts in Johnson & Johnson and I sell them to them, I'm not in the insurance business, right? I'm not. Yeah. My job is not to, you know, my account against the world in Johnson & Johnson. The first thing I'm going to do is buy calls and sell the stock, and hopefully between I can do that at a price better than I just sold you the put, so I just made my eighth or 10 cents or 20 cents and end up with a totally hedged position. So long call, short put, short stock is totally hedged. Now did I confuse the professor? whatever you do to the put, the same thing you do to the call. If you're long put, long stock, short call, you got the other side. One's called a reversal, that's, and one's called a conversion.
Yeah. My grandparents kind of did that when they farmed potatoes, right?
Yeah.
If they believe the price is going up, they're going to lock it in. They're not going to lock it in. They're going to wait until they harvest to sell their potatoes. But if they think that the potato price is going to be a bad year for potato prices, which means everybody's potato crop is awesome, that's going to push potato prices down. If they think that's going to happen this particular year, they're going to get a contract and sell them before they plant, right? So I mean, farmers have been doing this kind of thing for a long time.
Well, or they'll sell instead of hedging the whole crop. If they think the prices are going up, they'll hedge half, something like that.
Yeah. It's just a different combination of it. And if you're a smart farmer and you've got these humidity-controlled warehouses where you store your potatoes, it works much better too, because you can hang on to those potatoes a lot longer than somebody that just has a regular.
Well, that's a you hit on something that's somewhat interesting. Is I'm going to say we still used to have our Farm Friday on Stocks and Jacks, which we haven't had for a while. We should probably do that once in a while because Greg's capable of doing that. But we used to have a contributor to the show that would knew a lot of the farmers. And there was one year where I think, boy, you know, this is memory's fading a little bit, but there was one year where there was some big, was there a crisis in China or some damn place where everybody was buying, I forget, it was corn and soybeans just went up absolutely off the chart. And people, you could not get spot stuff. In other words, you couldn't, you could buy the futures, weren't that expensive because the futures were like November, but you couldn't, if you came and wanted to buy corn, there wasn't any, you know, or it was very little. So the next year, everybody had hedged at like, you know, whatever, 350, and corn's trading like 7 or some incredible number. So the next year, there were massive construction of silos at the farm because the farms didn't want to sell it all. They wanted to put it in their own storage. But the silo, you have to dry it and keep it. Not only are those dangerous, they're expensive. I mean, you need natural gas to dry it, depending on how much water there was. That's why if you get a year where you have great corn.
Yeah, I would suspect it'd be more expensive in a place of high humidity.
Well, but you also.
Out west, where it's really arid, it's not as expensive.
Sometimes, you get a year where you get all the rain you want during the season, and then you have three incredibly dry weeks in late September and October before you harvest, and you get stuff you barely have to dry. And some years, it rains all the way through, and the stuff is wet, and you got to dry it.
That explains why the almanac was used by farmers for, I don't know, a couple centuries, maybe more, right? Because, you know, people wanted to kind of predict the future, and they look up at the stars and try to figure out, is it going to be, you know, is the Earth, I don't know, closer to the sun this decade or not, you know? So they look up in the sky and make these observations and then associate them with weather patterns, and that's kind of how the almanac came about. Because people are trying to figure out, is it going to be a bumper crop or not, right?
Yep.
What's going to happen to the prices? Do I need to sell my potatoes before I plant them, or do I need to sell them after I harvest them, right?
Well, one of the summers we drove down, I hope it was a wedding and not a funeral, but my Italian family is in Columbus. So we drive down, and in one of the places, it's in, what the hell's the name of the town? There's a North Central Ohio University is there. It's a great little town. Anyways, but they have a big, what do you call it, a co-op guy, where the farmers sell all their corn to and so forth. And he's got a rail siding and all the other stuff, and he's got these, you know, really huge honking silos. Well, the silos were full, and the guy's got this huge parking lot for, like, trucks and stuff. The parking lot is about 100 feet high minimum in a pile of corn. I don't know how many bushels they're sitting in the parking lot. I mean, if I was a mouse in the field, it was the best day ever for me. I just went over and grabbed some corn for dinner, and but he didn't have enough room for it. So you know, you have to. All this stuff is such a complex business. What if the river is dry and you can't get a barge down or something? I mean, it's all this stuff is not easy. And matter of fact, one of the my brother Dan, one day, even though he has all kinds of other stuff doing for the firm when I'm doing the show, I'd love to get him on for just 10 minutes, probably when you're on, because when he was trading corn options back in the day, and there's all kinds of federal programs to help farmers out, crop insurance and blah, blah, blah. And he was privy, and I think he might have done some talks on it. There was a pilot program, and I think it was in the state of Indiana, where instead of having all this insurance and all that stuff, they just either lent the farmers money or did it for them. They essentially, if you put your corn in the ground at, corn was probably $3 at the time. If you put your corn in the ground at, at say $1.50 and the price is $3, just so you're going to make $1.50 a bushel, which is a lot. So say your spread was $1.50. I mean, if you could turn around and sell it at $3, you locked in your profit. But then if it went to $4, I mean, you're all pissed off because you could have got $4, right?
Yeah.
Well, the federal government had a program where you could buy the $3 puts.
Hmm.
So if the price went down to $1.50 to where you're back to break even, you made money on the puts. It was almost as, you paid a little premium. It's not the same as, well, maybe, you know, you paid some premium, I wouldn't say a little. You essentially bought insurance on the price at $3 without actually selling your crop at $3. And it was a huge success over 2 or 3 years. Dan knows more about this than me. I can say let him do it. But all of a sudden, they cancel the program. Because all the people who were in the insurance and stuff would all be out of a job. You just buy puts. Why do you need insurance? Because, right? I mean, well, the nice thing about, you know, the puts, if you sell the corn at $3, all right, and you decide, now your risk is that if the price goes to $6, you lose $3 on the future, right? And what you sold against it, and I know this could be the over-the-head show today, you lose $3 on the future, but now you can sell your corn for $6, and so you make up the difference, correct?
Yeah.
Well, what happens if a hailstorm lands on your farm or your creek floods and you don't have the corn to deliver? Well, that's a problem. Now, if you've got the puts, instead of selling it, you just, all you did was lose the money on the puts. You're not having to deliver corn $3 higher than when you don't have it. But who's to say that there isn't going to be some massive hailstorm hitting your county or a tornado running through your field, right?
Yeah, we had that problem all the time when I was a kid. It seemed like whenever a storm came up, my dad was always panicking because he didn't want it to flatten the wheat.
Right, oh yeah.
If it flattens wheat, it's going to be a very rough winter. Let's just say that.
Well, you know, doesn't wheat have the oldest genetic engineering of any crop, I believe?
I think it does, yeah. And corn does too. I think corn originated kind of almost as like a grass, thousands of years ago.
Well, it was maize. Then, it was some kind of, it was the Indian plant, right? Maize?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And then potatoes came from South America, I think, right? The Spanish conquered South America and they discovered potatoes down there. And then they brought them to Europe and they made their way into Ireland, I think, right? And then I think the Irish kind of brought them to the United States.
Well, there were some kind of tubers, which potato is, right?
Yeah.
Some kind of root something something. But the I think wheat, and this is why I think some people think why a lot of people are, what's the people that can't eat wheat? It's what's
gluten? Gluten,
yeah,
tolerant.
It's a gluten and
I'm a glutton for gluten. I'll tell you that.
Well, a lot of Irish people actually have issues with gluten. For whatever reason. Yeah. But I think there was I don't know the whole history of this, but you know, whenever you see the Amber Waves of Grain commercials as they play the national anthem, and you see
the day of television at midnight, they would shut down and they'd play that. Yeah.
But you'd see the wheat dancing back and forth, you know, straight up in the air, with the going back and forth in the wind. Well, wheat didn't used to do that. It would just get knocked flat by any kind of rain or anything.
Yeah.
So whatever the first, I don't even think they knew it was a genetic engineering, but somebody somewhere hundreds of years ago did something to wheat, essentially gave wheat Viagra and made it stand straight up. That's a man-made deal. So that
if you're a farmer. If you're a farmer and that happens to you a lot, and you notice that some stocks are standing straight up and down, and some stocks aren't, you're probably going to think to yourself, "Hey, I need to," because people have been playing with seeds for a long time.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
They're probably thinking, "I need to interact these wheat plants over here. You know, maybe harvest those seeds over here." And so I think over the course of hundreds of years, people kind of figured those things out.
I think it was the first actual piece of documented genetic engineering, whatever it was. I mean, I've read this. I mean, we need a good farmer in here to talk about this, but it changed it, and some of the allergies to it, some people will swear it's because of that, because it was never tested.
Yeah. The thing about, I think, broccoli and Brussels sprouts, there's like 8 vegetables that don't look at all similar, and they come from the same plant.
Broccoli, cauliflower, like Brussels sprouts.
It's like 8 of them.
Yeah.
It does not. They do not look like they came from the same plant, but over the course of 100 years, you have these 8 distinct vegetables.
Aren't they all roots of the cabbage family? I think they are.
I think they are. Yeah, I think they are, yeah.
Well, yeah. One of the, Chris, who used to be on the show with us, he would go and they, for those that, I mean, I've never done it, but they would go, for some reason, you see these massive combines harvesting corn, right?
Yeah. And,
well, that's all, for lack of a better term, horse corn, as my grandfather used to call it. It's feed corn. Now, if you get it at the, on the right day, feed corn, I guess, can be, because my grandfather, he was really into this. I mean, he was an Italian guy. He loved to do his tomatoes and stuff. He said if you actually go harvest the horse corn, he used to call it, on the right day, it's as tender as sweet corn. But, of course, they let it grow, and it's all for animals. It's animal feed. It's not something you and I would eat. Well, sweet
corn...
Yeah,
animals have a different stomach system. I think the cows have like a couple stomachs where they can eat grass, and humans just can't, can't do that.
Well, but the horse corn, but then there's sweet corn, has to be picked by hand. There's I don't think there's a machine that, harvests sweet corn for some reason. I don't know why. But anyway, Chris and these people, they would go harvest... They take, like, you know, they all had Suburbans or pickup trucks. They go and harvest, like, 90 gazillion, you know, sweet corn pieces and bring them to the food depository. You know, which, you know, they were doing their part for, and people love, obviously, sweet corn. I do. And so they would go, and he said, the stuff has been so genetically engineered now that you don't need as many insecticides. I mean, it's really good for the soil and everything else.
Yeah.
He said, but it is so freaky to go down the row. And you got to be covered with nets and everything because the bugs are all over you, and yet they're not on the corn.
because they're
like hovering around the corn and they don't want to land. And he goes, "What the hell is in this corn?" it makes you really wonder what is in this corn where mosquitoes don't want to eat it. And by the way, I'm gonna eat it.
Well, there was the
bugs that eat corn.
There was a agricultural scientist on John Stossel's show that he had on TV a decade ago, and she was telling the audience on that show that the human-made pesticides and herbicides are probably much safer for human consumption than the plants, because plants have a natural, they create a natural herbicide or a pesticide to defend themselves against pests. And she was saying that those are probably more safe than, and I think that's why a lot of people, I think when people eat like berries in the wild, that's probably what they're experiencing, right? These pesticides and herbicides that these plants make naturally can be more dangerous than the human-made ones, according to this, you know, scientist that was.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're all chemicals, but I mean, you wonder, like Chris says, the bugs are landing on me like there's no tomorrow, and yet they want no part of the corn.
Well, you know, the funny thing about that is I never get bugged by mosquitoes, but my wife and kids, they'll just get bitten left and right. I don't know what it is. Maybe mosquitoes are racist because I'm white. My wife's black.
They
I do not get bit by bugs.
This is so freaky. I mean, it's probably not. We got a minute before the break, but this is not economic talk. But mosquitoes, since I was hatched, have absolutely loved me. Absolutely love me. To the point.
You have a lot of sugar in your diet?
Well, I mean, a lot of people think it's if you run a little hotter, or it's some other thing. But I'm sitting. He's been on a show a couple of times. My buddy Butcher Al, he's a chef Butcher Al. He likes to go hunting, and he actually has classes in butchering stuff for people and stuff. But anyway,
oh, wow.
He's been on the air a couple of times on running restaurants, and he goes out and harvests mushrooms. Which, of course, I would never do because I'd get the ones that are poisonous, right? You got to know what you're doing to pick mushrooms.
Yeah.
And he goes out and he gets the really good ones for the restaurant, but he knows which ones are poisonous. So he's telling me one night, he goes, yeah, I got to really get myself all trussed up to go out into the woods because the ticks are all over me.
Wow.
And I go, what do you mean? And he goes, yeah, the ticks absolutely love me. Now, ticks absolutely hate me. And I've been, I mean, you know, Audrey, the two mongrels will sometimes be sleeping with us. And once in a while, I'll feel this thing walking across me. You know, not often. I mean, it's a tick from one of the dogs, right? But they want no part of me. They can't wait to get off me. Yet a mosquito will find me in a room of 100 people, without a doubt. Yeah.
Well, it just goes to show you that Western medicine that wants to treat everybody identical, right? They won't approve a drug unless it's 95% effective. To me, that's just wrong.
Oh, yeah.
Wrong thinking, because we're all so unique. Some people can't eat fava beans, right?
Yeah.
Some people can't drink this highly pasteurized milk. So we're just all unique. We're all different, and you can't you can't standardize medicine. It has to be tailored to individuals.
Well, that's why, you know, when they Al, to complete the wacky story, Al says to me, he goes, I don't ever get mosquito bites. I rarely get one, but ticks love me. And I'm going, wait a minute, mosquitoes love me and ticks hate me. There's obviously some difference. It's got to be a blood type. It's got to be something.
Yeah, yeah. Well, with alcohol, with beer or alcohol, my nickname in the Navy was Two Beers, because if I have two, I'm like, I don't remember anything at all. I'm blacked out.
Well, I mean, every people's response to that obviously can be a lot different. But, you know, that's why when I don't know enough to know, like, the autism and all the other stuff. But I've had, you know, fortunately, I've been, you know, relatively very healthy my whole life, knock on wood.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've had some prescription drugs along the way, like most people. And I tell you what, I'm a big guy. And doctors look at me and say, we can give this guy anything. I have real problems taking just about anything. And yet other people, I take the same drug. Nothing bothers me. And I'm like, geez, I can't take that at all. Yet, so when you talk about giving, you know, kids these inoculations, I think they're probably safe for just about everybody. But I don't know that you can give, you know, three or four different diseases in the same shot for every baby, and nobody has a reaction to it. Because, yeah. I mean, how can you say nobody will?
Yeah, if you listen to RFK Jr., he finds a significant association between autism rates and the number of vaccines that kids are now given.
I wonder if it's the number of the vaccines or whether they give them all at once.
Yeah.
I mean, why can't you do one at a time?
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe it's not as efficient, right? You need a...
Well, it's not efficient for the doctor, but who cares about him? I mean,
yeah,
right.
But, you know, for the pharmaceutical industry and the doctor system.
Well, I mean, wouldn't you rather have a... What does it cost to take care of somebody for autism for 60 years?
Yeah.
Good, well, not to mention the person.
To a pediatrician administering government-approved vaccines that are required for you to attend public school, and if you don't attend public school, you're truant, right?
Yeah.
And then your kids can be taken away from you in certain cities. There's kind of a coercion there, right?
Well,
that particular doctor's not really worried about, you know, the autism of that child, you know, 15 years down the road, right? They're just worried about getting that shot.
Well, one of my
arm.
Buddies demanded that they do one at a time, and the doctor did it.
Yeah.
Anyway,
oh, really?
We gotta
okay.
go, let's yeah. go to break and back talk about some. I didn't mention with Russell a little bit with Carl. What's this Japanese move going to do? It's not moving the market at all, but them cutting back on some of their purchases and so forth. S&P futures down 23. As if you're just down 129, we're kind of reversing yesterday's gain. Be right back, Stocks and Jocks.
Are you one of the millions of people who suffer with pain? Do you wake up in the morning with stiffness in the lower back or neck? Why are you using medication to cover up the symptoms without treating the actual cause? Painkillers, muscle relaxants, and anti-inflammatories are not the answer. At ChiroMed, physicians are trained to detect the cause of your symptoms and to correct the underlying problem. If you're ready to listen to common sense and do what it takes to make changes in your body that can affect your health for the rest of your life, give ChiroMed a call and set up a complimentary consultation. They are located in Orland Park and can be reached at 708-403-2727. 20,000 patients over 22 years have been treated at ChiroMed, and over 90% of them have had positive results without medication or expensive surgery. Isn't it time you did something good for your body too? Give ChiroMed a call, 708-403-2727. That's 708-403-2727. Let's get you pain-free and living again.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Hear ye, hear ye! The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air!
Stocks, jocks,
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control!
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Lower North Bank Stocks Jacks. I'm talking about running the board. S&P futures down 23. NASDAQ futures down 128. Dow futures. We get the latest here. I'm looking at individual stocks. All the stocks in the Magnificent Seven are down. NVIDIA is down $23 after their big conference last night. It's
busted through 900 two or three times. If people wanted to get out, they had their chance. Now it's trading 861. A big mover on the day and yesterday as well. It's MicroStrategies. I think it started the week 1700. Now it's 1340. Ouch. So that's down a bunch. But the options were priced that way, so it's not a surprise to anybody. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX up 13. Call that flat. Puts you down 14. Make that 0.2%. Check around up 22.3%. So very, very not much over in Europe, considering everybody else is pretty busy. Nikkei up 263.7%, over 40,000, 40,003. This is the effort of Bank of Japan raises their interest rates for the first time in like 17 years. Hang Seng down 207, 16,529. Shanghai down 22, 3,062. Way of review, like I said yesterday, Dow was up 75, S&P was up 32, and now we're down 22. NASDAQ was up 130, and now we're down 130 in NASDAQ. So, again, we're kind of flipping back and forth. Bonds down 2 basis points, 4.32. The Bund unchanged, 2.45. Japan actually down 2 basis points. You would think it would be up, but it's not. 0.75. Oil up 12 cents, 82.84. Brent up 9 cents, 86.98. Natural gas up 5 cents, but still real low at 175. RBOB down a penny, 274. Foreign exchange, not much there. The euro still at 108.5. British pound at 127, almost even. Gold down 770, 2156, seemingly kind of right at home now in his mid-2100s, not 2000s, but 2100s. Silver down 20 cents, 2506. We've got Bitcoin down 3600, 63,495. That's what's causing MicroStrategy down. It's down 10,000 bucks in 2 days. It's going up pretty fast, it's going down faster. Ryan, what do you got for us? A quick traffic weather sports.
Hey folks, for those of you who may or may not have been with us earlier this morning, the Bulls beat the Portland Trailblazers yesterday 110-107. In preseason news, the Cubs beat the Rangers 8-6 Sunday, and the Sox lost to the Cleveland Guardians 5-8. And in a shock to everybody, the Blackhawks somehow beat the Sharks 5-2. What do you think of that, Tom?
Well, they scored two winners back-to-back a couple of weeks ago. We're scoring a little more, so...
Yes, but are we scoring enough, Tom?
No, but some kid from Notre Dame just joined the team, so...
Oh, good for him. Yeah, look at that.
That center, though, they redrafted it. Connor Bedard, he's the real deal.
So I've heard.
Yeah.
So I've heard. And in regards to weather, it is currently 31 degrees in Chicago with a high of 53 today with some breezes and a few clouds coming up. In Phoenix, Arizona, it's still 50 degrees with a high of 76 with partly cloudy skies expected. Right now, in regards to traffic, you got the inbound Kennedys sitting at about 56 minutes inbound. Inbound Edens is at 61 minutes. Inbound Eisenhower at an even 60 minutes. And you got the Dan Ryan estimated to be about 29 minutes into the city. And finally, the inbound Stevenson travel time is looking to be about 41 minutes as of right now.
I'd turn back if I were you.
Honestly, yes. I'm with you 100%.
So we're back to Hal, Professor. We've solved all the problems of the world in agriculture and stuff. What do you make of this Japanese? Well, you know, it's funny. I've been talking to, we had a big conversation yesterday with Nancy and everybody else regarding, because she's our mortgage lady, about what's going on in individual families. And I'm going to say that the one of the differences in how I look at the world and a lot of maybe a few other people on the show, and how the big shot prognosticators on TV and the politicians look at the world, is they look at the numbers and come down from there. I look at the individual people and add up from there. And yeah. I think there's a whole different view on which direction you look right now, in terms of people struggling, people with the with the kind of rates, not the rates, with the inflation rates we've had, with salaries maybe not going up. It's been a tremendous change in this society in terms of wealth building in my lifetime. When I was younger, if you got a good job, you all lived in the same neighborhood, had the same house, and if somebody made a little bit more per week, he was able to save more. But now it's the savings are, well, people do have their 401k, so I can't discount that. But the savings are not increasing. If you're going to get wealth now, it's because you bought somehow Nvidia at $50, and now it's $900 or $850. And
The wealth is in these bubbles. Not bubbles, but in asset pricing. It's in your house. It's in, it's, and it's kind of a lot different, because I think you and I, if we were to look at a competitive society, a free market, the owners of stuff wouldn't necessarily do that much better than the lessors of the same stuff, because they would be doing something else with the money that should be earning as much as the difference, right? I mean, you could never, I mean, I don't think I would ever get a above a C paper for you if you told me to assume a perfectly competitive capitalist environment, and over the period of 30 years, all the owners did way better than other people. I don't know that you would necessarily would say that that's true, and yet it has been true, right?
Well, yeah, I don't think we live in a free society. I think it's a big illusion. And I mean, look at example at an article I read, I think, a week and a half ago. I mentioned it, I think, last Tuesday, but it's about people who, you know, just everyday Americans, you know, at the median, maybe at the first quartile or second quartile or third quartile of the income distribution, not the top 20%, but everybody else. I mean, people are racking up record amounts of debt, and they're tapping their 401ks. And I mean, just think about what a 401k is. It government requires you to keep this money in this account, to keep your money in this account for your own good.
Except you, every year there's, not every year, every couple of years, there's another way to get it out of there.
Yeah, but if you want to take it out early, in most instances, if you want to take it out early, you got to pay a penalty, right?
You can borrow it for yourself.
Yeah.
You can borrow.
But what I'm saying is you can't take it out. When you borrow it from yourself, that means you have to put it back. So you're really not taking it
out.
But
if you
can't withdraw it.
If you run up $30,000, I think somebody told me they did this. I've not done it. But if you run up a $30,000 credit card bill, I think you can borrow from your 401k and at least pay yourself interest that's less than 22%. Hmm. Yeah, I think you can. I'm not sure how you do that, but please don't go do that, because I said so. But you can actually, you know, what I wanted to get to is I went out to dinner with a group, a couple, terrific, you know, we had a really nice time Saturday night. But of course, I said, "What? Well, we're going out on Saturday night. It's like St. Patrick's Day. You better find an Italian place or a Thai place. we're not going to an Irish joint on St. Patrick's Day to be able to talk." So
Packed.
So we find this really good Italian place. We go, and first time I met them, but they're listeners to the show, and whatever, Audrey sold their house, and they became good friends. And you know, Aud becomes everybody's buddy when she sells a place. I mean, she's that friendly, and she does a good job. So I mean, that's why all her business is referrals. I mean, anyway. So they asked me. They said, "How much is your business harder than it used to be, or whatever?" And I said, "Well, it's all about your clientele. I mean, we had several different groups that we." Traditionally have done business with, and it's generally been retiring couples that would we're talking in the 90s and they would, the 401ks, if both people worked and the company matched, magically the number was somewhere between $1.1 million and $1.4 million. I mean, just the way the rules were, and if you didn't take anything out, that's where you were. The deal the government made, when they're not going to get any other pension, so that's their pension. So it sounds like a lot of money, but now that's what they have to live off of the rest of their life, with Social Security, right, and any other savings they might have. Well, if you put that, say it's $1.1 million, and you put it in a bank at risk-free rates, which used to be 3%, okay, so that's $32,000 a year. Your Social Security is another 25, so you're pushing 60. Right, which is, and if your house is paid off, 60 used to be plenty, you know, to get your car every 5 years and put the roof on every 15 years, and you know, that was plenty to live on, right?
Yeah.
And a risk-free, well, but I don't think I had a soul came in. Now, maybe there were people, they just didn't come in. I don't have anybody, hell, who essentially had co-opted that number. And now, I'm not going to say nobody, but I don't think, I heard a thing yesterday on BBM, news radio, which I'll give them the credit because they did it. Some lady was on talking about how many people, some huge percentage of parents, have either tap that money for a down payment from one of their kids' houses or a grandkid's medical expense or have somebody living at home. But the average drain, I don't know where the hell she got these numbers, the average drain for the average retiree now is at least $1,300 to $1,500 a month for one of their kids, either for a medical expense or they're living at home again or something. The savings isn't making it to 65 being savings. It's being drawn upon by, you know, either some kid ran up a credit card bill or somebody had an emergency room issue, 10 grand, don't have it, that sort of thing. And I think, you know, that's, it's all over the place for people. And these are not, we're not talking about low-class people. We're talking about people that have worked in what used to be the middle class. They're not making it unencumbered. And it, well, it's hurt my business, obviously, because, you know, I don't see people walking in every month saying, here's my million and a half. I haven't touched it in 25 years. Because they have.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I think things are different. The groups that we know are not as well off, even though they might have a nice house and a car. I mean, there's no way one of these people with a 60 grand, you know, deal a year risk-free is going to go out and buy an $80,000 pickup. How the hell are they going to do that?
Yeah. No, I mean, there's just no way.
No way.
And here's another problem that I think people who really care about their kids and their kids' futures is that the public school education, for the most part, especially in the inner cities, is so bad that you have to pay not only tuition to that public school in your neighborhood via your property taxes and other taxes that end up in the public school system. Not only are you forced to pay that tuition, but in order to get your kids a really good education, you have to finance that education
right
at a private school in order to set your kids up for success. And that's one thing that my wife and I have been trying to do, is trying to figure out how to provide a quality primary and secondary education to our kids so they're well prepared for college or whatever they end up doing when they turn 18. And, you know, we can't trust our kids in the neighborhood public school like my parents could. You know, when I grew up in Idaho, you know, the teachers lived in the community. They were held accountable every day by the parents in that community in interactions, whether it be at church or whether it be at the mercantile or the gas station, right?
Yep.
But in these inner cities, the teachers don't even live in the neighborhoods. And the quality of the education is so horrible that, you know, if you want your kids to have a better life, you have to pay out of pocket to get that education for them. And that's one of the unfortunate things about it.
Well, I don't see how. I mean, there's obviously, I live in a neighborhood. I'm not, you know, I don't own, I rent, but it's considered, you know, one of the higher priced neighborhoods in the city. But there's still rental places like I have, but you're talking about $25,000-$30,000 a year in property tax.
Yeah, it's like a mortgage unto itself.
Yeah, it's like a mortgage unto, and then if your kids don't go to the school. I mean, on my block, when I used to take Scruff out for a walk every morning, you know, before I did the show with John at 5, so we'd be out at 4. Sure enough, Saturday morning, Scruff didn't know it was Saturday. He's nudging me to go for his walk at 4. So we're walking down the block, and there's people sitting in these lawn chairs having coffee. There's a little park down the block, and they're trying to get their kids in the summer daycare programs and so forth. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, get this straight, I'm paying 35 grand in taxes, and I got to stay up all night to get my kid in the, hire another park guy for the 35 grand. Man, Jesus. Yeah. I mean, we can't all get in here with the amount of money we're paying. I mean, what kind of picture is this? And, you know, and
I think the internet is going to really, AI and the internet is going to really disrupt the public school education system and the university system. I think it's going to really disrupt it. I think parents are going to find maybe an AI. I mean, maybe AI is teaching their kids in the future, right? So I think there's massive disruption coming to the public school system because parents want something else. And under this current regime, under this current model, it makes it really difficult for parents to save, you know, which they should for their retirement. I mean, if you're spending all your money on educating your kids outside the broken public school system, you don't have much of a, you know, nest egg to sit back on.
Well, your numbers just don't hack up. I mean, match up, hack up. What's the difference? I mean, if you the Chicago Public Schools right now. Now, I can't go crazy on individual teachers because
I don't think it's the system.
But where the families in areas where the families are totally broken down.
Yeah.
I think you could be Solomon and not be able to teach in that school. Yeah. I mean, I heard stories where half the kids are on Ritalin, and if they take the Ritalin, they're asleep on their desk, and if they don't, they're bouncing around the walls. You know, I mean, half the kids are drugged. I mean, there's no support at home, that kind of thing in some areas. But still, if you add the numbers up, so say you lived on my block, and you had just a regular house, it's okay, $25,000-$30,000. Now, the Catholic schools, I mean, I don't know about the other private schools, but the Catholic schools seem to be able, the high schools, to dish out a really good education in the $16,000-$17,000 a year range.
Yeah.
Is their cost. I know people are on boards of some of these places. Now, you know, if you're Loyola and you've got every conceivable athletic thing in the world, it's going to be a lot more because, you know, you're almost like you're at a small university, for God's sake.
Yeah.
But now, the Chicago Public Schools, I think, the student gets somewhere in the high 20s when he shows up for high school. That doesn't account the building expenses. So even if it's 26 and the building expenses are another 5 or 6, so you're talking 30. So you're damn near double at what some of these Catholic schools are doing in high school. You know.
Well, here's the reason why there's a difference in the quality. Parents can, you know, and these private schools know this, the Catholic schools know this. If they don't do a good job of educating the kids, the parents are just going to simply take them out of the system.
But they can also boot the kid out, which is
and the school can boot the kid out too, yeah. Right? So the parents can walk away. The school can walk away. So I think that holds the parents and the kids accountable on one end, but it also holds the teachers and the principal accountable.
Oh, sure. Without a doubt.
Parents, right? But at a public school in a poor neighborhood, do the parents really have any choices? I mean, they have to send their kid to this public school.
Well, you can actually, that's the big problem. Well, problem, yeah, according to the teachers union in Chicago, is you do have charter schools.
Yeah. But the charter schools are so heavily regulated that I'm not sure if the quality. I think that what the charter school has different is the fact that parents will pull their kids out if they don't believe their kids are going to go to.
Well, I think the charter school can boot you too. I'm not positive on that.
Yeah.
But I mean, what I'm saying is, and the solution is always more money. But I don't see the numbers game.
Oh, I don't see the solution as being more money.
Well, I mean, their solution, not necessarily mine. But
my solution would be more like the Swedish model, where parents, instead of the administrator being given the check, the parents are given the piece of paper that allows them to put their kids, enroll their kids in any school they want.
You're talking about the Canadian model.
That's the Swedish model.
Well, the Canadian model is the same one, I think.
Yeah. But the Swedish model, I think, is the key that we need in the United States.
Well, in theory, in Chicago, and again, boy, I hope somebody's listening really knows this. I think the charter school, because one of the guys in the buildings here, is his kid goes, the charter school deal is the money that follows the student. But you don't get any money. In other words, if it was going to be the Hallin Chief Charter School, we need to operate the building. And if we attract 100 kids from the Chicago public school system or wherever they come from, we're going to get the $25,000 per kid for the education, but they don't pay for the building, I think, is the deal.
That's one piece of it. But the other piece of it is freedom. Freedom from government regulators.
Well, that's why the Catholic school system, and again, I'm partial to that, but I mean, if they gave them $5,000 a kid, not even the full 25, most of them wouldn't close. That's how close they are.
Yeah.
Because the parents, you know, want to pay something. They just can't pay the whole number. So yeah. I don't see how you avoid not giving them at least some of the money.
Yeah. See, the problem with the real problem, that one issue about is the money attached to the kid or not. That's one issue, right? The other issue is this top down, you have to do it this way or we're going to put you out of business accreditation model that the states use, right? I think if you let the schools figure it out for themselves.
Well, there's no tests anymore or anything these kids have to take. I mean, they're pulling back on that.
What I'm talking about is the schools are forced to hire a teacher with a license. They're forced. They have to, in New York State, they have these tests that the students have to pass in the spring and in the summer, or in the spring and the fall.
Here they wouldn't be passing.
Yeah. But so one of the issues is that the state strangles the type of education that is going on. It dictates it, right?
Right.
And so if the state did not do that, and parents and the money was tied to the child, schools of infinite variety would pop up everywhere. There'd be a school for kids who like physics. There'd be a school that pops up where it's mathematics. There'd be a school for athletics. There'd be a school for this and that, for drama. There'd be schools everywhere, and kids would be running cheerfully. They wouldn't be sleeping in their chairs, in their seats. They couldn't wait to get to school.
Wait a minute.
In a system where
I couldn't. All I did was watch the clock.
No, I'm telling you, in this system where the state does not dictate curriculum or who can be hired and who cannot be hired, in that free system, in that system free of government, you'd have schools popping up everywhere that could cater to kids with special needs.
Right, but I'm being argumentative here. I know might have stuff that is good for the kids and the parents would love. But you're still going to have to sit there and learn how to diagram sentences while you're staring at the clock.
Well, I know. I agree with 100%, but...
You're still not going to like it if you're a kid. Who the hell likes school?
I disagree because I see kids that are just like walking, trudging their way into the big public school in the neighborhood. Yeah. And then I see the kids who are like skipping to school, going to a little charter school next to it, right? So I think you would see more of that. I think when a student walks into a classroom that they have to be in, if they're not there, they're going to be truant, and they're too truant, then the state will threaten to take the kids.
Yeah, but no matter who you are, there's going to be classes that you can't stand.
I know, I agree, yeah. I agree. But if you're in a school that you really like and you want to stay,
if your buddies are there and it's decent,
and your friends are there,
and you're playing ball for the place and everything, there's no doubt. The school, in my neighborhood, the Catholic neighborhood, it was the community.
Yeah,
all your buddies were there. I mean, everybody's mom knew everybody else. I mean, you knew the teacher might live down the block. I mean, the thought of me going somewhere else would never even cross my mind. I mean,
you as a kid, you're probably going to work a little harder in a school such as that than one that you're forced to go to because you have no means.
Well, you didn't want to get an F if your buddy's getting an A. But still, there's more to this, and I'm saying the numbers don't read out. And today we're going to the polls in the city. We'll see how many. You know, I have something I want to run by. This is sort of interesting. We've only got a few minutes. Is one of the reasons, there was a lady on, again, VBM. She was given a report, and she blamed a lot of the tax increases on the voters. And I'm sitting there going, where the hell is she going with this? And yet, she came up with, you should never judge until you hear. She went through how many referendums on taxing were in the state of Illinois in the last however many years, and how many of them had passed, and if they didn't, they were on the ballot like the next time. And she said the weird part is most of them that have passed, the amount of people that showed up to vote was less than like 25% or something.
Yeah.
So she goes, to a large extent, a lot of the increases in the property taxes have been voted on by people who didn't show up to vote.
Yeah.
it's like your own, you can't ever say collectively it's society's fault because that doesn't get you anywhere, right? But I'm sitting there listening to this, I'm going, that's true. Now, today there's going to be this vote on whether you raise the transfer tax on property. It's a horrendous idea. And I've listened to people trying to explain how it's a good idea. I don't think they could pass Economics 101. They don't realize that it's a property tax increase, and that when you're trying to help the homeless get an apartment, the last thing you want to do is increase the price of the property. I mean, duh. I mean,
are you gonna have more landlords?
No, they're gonna at some point, if you sell a house for like $1.5 million or $2 million, you got to pay like a 4% transfer tax.
Wow.
So like if you sell a place for $2 million, you got to pay the city like $60,000 or something. That's kind of a lot. But it's allegedly, and they claim it's going to be sequestered money just for the homeless. I don't. We're talking with John Flanagan about it. I don't believe that for a second.
Yeah, anytime they say it's sequestered, I don't buy it at all.
Well, because January, I thought, I mean, foolishly, I thought if it became a separate taxing thing, like if it was for the mosquito abatement district or something, is a separate line on your bill, I thought that actually had to go to the mosquito abatement district. And Jan goes, that doesn't even have to go there either. So just the mayor saying, don't worry, it's all for the homeless, I don't believe this guy for a second.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like saying the lottery had to go for education.
I'm just think about the administrative salaries they're going to be paid to administer this thing.
Well, they're talking. I just got a thing from Greg, who sends me a lot of stuff, of how many people in the homeless shelters here for the immigrants. People are donating food, and they're buying their own food. And yet the city's saying it's cost them like, you know, $1 billion a minute to feed these people. I don't think they're feeding any of them. Where's this money going? Is it going to the Hal and Chief catering? And we're going out and drinking martinis every night? Where's it going?
Yeah.
Anyway, how are things in New York? Okay?
Yeah, it was nice on Sunday. I mean, I was without a coat on Sunday, but man, I'll tell you, yesterday I walked out in my shorts to pick up my son and I froze.
Oh, it's freezing today here. Well, did you go to the parade?
No, we didn't go to the parade.
How often do you have to drive down to Carolina?
Like once a week or so.
Well, that's kind of a kick.
Yeah.
Why don't you?
I don't mind driving though. I'm from Idaho. I had to drive 120 miles to go to a rock concert.
Why don't you get yourself a little Piper and fly?
Yeah. I mean, just the storage and the parking and the airport licensing, yeah, that would be costly.
Move out to some place on Long Island. We got your own little runway.
Well, I'd have to pay, one, a mortgage, and two, the property tax, which equals the mortgage.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. All right, Bo, take care of yourself. I'll get you next week. Good stuff.
Okay.
What did you think of our VIX discussion?
Oh, I got in a little late.
Okay.
Yeah, I got in too late to comment on that.
All Sorry. Right.
Plus, I was getting a cup of coffee while I was logged into Zoom.
Oh, God. All right, bud. Well, take care of yourself. Talk to you next week. SP Futures coming back a little bit, only down 16. NASDAQ only down 97, was down 130. So we're coming back. Maybe we'll come all the way back. Be right back tomorrow morning. Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to ptisecurities.com. PTI Pro Direct. Trade for as low as a penny per share and a dollar per option contract. Learn more at ptiprodirect.com. Nadex, offering an intuitive way to trade the financial markets. Visit nadex.com. HomeSource Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit hamzyanalytics.com. ChiroMed. Back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. DAX Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.
That's all, folks.